Chapter 2. A Chinese Army construction battalion arrived at Tunghua, 43 miles inside the Korean frontier, on July 4, 1951, to set underway the housing for events planned in 1936 that were to reach their conclusion in the United States of America in 1960. The major in charge of the detail, a Sung Ma Sung, is now a civilian lawyer in Kunming. Manchuria is in the subarctic zone, but the summers are hot and humid. Tunghua handles industry, such as sawmilling and food processing, with hydroelectric power. It is a city of approximately 90,000, about the size of Terre Haute, Indiana, but lacking a public health appropriation. The Chinese construction battalion set up the job near a military airfield, nearly 3 miles out of town. Everything they put up was prefabricated, the sections keyed by different colors. This, when the pieces were scattered around the terrain, made the men seem like toy figures walking among the pieces of a giant jigsaw puzzle. When they were assembled into a building, they were sprayed with barn red lead paint to banish the quilted effect. By July 6th, at 1719, the battalion had completed a two-story, 22-room structure with a small auditorium. The building was called the Research Pavilion and had some one-way transparent glass walls. It also had a few comfortably furnished guest rooms without glass walls on the first floor. These had been reserved for the brass from Moscow and Peiping. Each floor held different colored, very patterned asphalt tile as a guide for furniture and equipment placement. Each wall, as it was erected, had decorations riveted into it. The windows, cut through each outer wall, had curtains and drapes fastened to them. The 1,000 pieces of that house gave the impression that it was a traveling billet for political representatives of the Allied people's governments, a structure forever being built, struck, then sent on ahead to be built again for the next series of meetings and discussions. All of the furniture was made of blonde wood in mutated modern Scandinavian design. All of the interior coloring, except the bright yellow rattan carpeting on the second floor, was the same green and apricot utilized by new brides during their first 3 years of marriage. The second floor of the building held one large corner suite of rooms and 10 other compact cubicles that had 3 solid walls each and one building-long common wall of one-way transparent glass, facing a catwalk that was patrolled day and night by 2 Soviet Army riflemen. Each cubicle contained a cot, a chair, a closet, and a mirror for reassurance that the soul had not fled. The large apartment had similar fittings, plus a bathroom, a large living room, and an additional bedroom. All of the walls here were opaque. The invigorating scent of pine tree incense pervaded the upper floors, subtly and pleasantly. The marvelous part of what they were doing several hundred miles to the south of Tunghua was that every time Mavoli moved, the girl moved, and every time Mavoli bleated, the girl bleated. It was really a money's worth. And after Mavoli came downstairs, he told the guys that the classy part about the joint was that when he took the broad upstairs in the first place, there'd been no jeers or catcalls. Mavoli's co-mover and bleater was a young Korean girl who had adapted to prostitution, a variation of the Rochdale principle on which had been based the first cooperative store in 1844, in that she extended absolutely no credit, but distributed part of the profits in the form of free beer. Her name was Gertrude. Freeman had left to check gear, but Mavoli and Bobby Lembeck sat around and drank a few more beers while they waited for the corporal to get finished upstairs. They tried to explain to the 2 little broads that it was not necessary to smile so hard, but they couldn't speak Korean, except for a few words, and the girls couldn't speak American. So Bobby Lembeck put his 2 forefingers at the corners of his mouth and pulled an inane prop smile down. The girls caught on, but it looked so funny the way he did it that Bobby and Mavoli started laughing like crazy, which started the girls laughing again, so that when they stopped laughing, they were still smiling. To the extent that wartime zymergists imperil the norm, the Korean beer was about as good as local Mississippi beer or Nebraska beer, which is pretty lousy. But it was hot. That was one thing you could say about it, Mavoli pointed out.
Eddie, why do we have to spend all of our time off in a whorehouse? Bobby asked.
Yeah, rough, ain't it?
I don't mean it's hard to take, but my hobby is birds. There are a lot of new birds around this part of the world.
We spend our time off here because it's the only place on the entire Korean Peninsula that Sergeant Raymond Shaw doesn't walk into,
You think he's a fairy or very religious?
What?
Or both?
Sergeant Shaw? Our Raymond?
Yeah.
What are you, out of your mind? It's just that Raymond doesn't give to anybody. And it's a common, vulgar thing, sex, to Raymond.
He happens to be right,
Bobby Lembeck said.
It sure is. I'm only a beginner, but that's one of the things I like about it.
Mavoli looked at him, nodding his head in a kind of awe.
It's a very funny thing, he said slowly. But every now and then I think about you coming all the way to Korea from New Jersey to get your first piece of poontang. And it makes me feel like I'm sort of a monument. Part of your life, you know? And Mary Louise, too, of course.
He nodded equably to indicate the small Japanese girl who was sitting beside Bobby Lembeck, holding his right wrist like a falcon.
She certainly is, Bobby agreed. What a monument!
It's kind of a very touching thing to me that you have never had a fat broad or a tall broad, say.
It's different?
Well, yes and no. It's hard to explain. These little broads, while very nice and with lovely dispositions, and with beer included, which is very unusual, they are very little. Spinners, we used to call them. And although I hate to say this, even though I know they can't understand me, they are very, very skinny.
Just the same, Bobby said.
Yeah, you're right.
Melvin the corporal came rushing down the stairs. He was combing his hair rapidly, head tilted to one side like a commuter who had overslept.
Great, he said briskly. Great, 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 he repeated, running the words together. The greatest.
You're telling me? Asked Bobby Lembeck.
Look at him, Mavoli said proudly. Already he's an expert on getting laid.
All right, you guys, Melvin said in a corporal's voice. We move up north in half an hour. Let's go.
Bobby Lembeck kissed Marie Louise's hand.
Mansae, he said,
using the only Korean word he knew. It voiced a gallant hope, for it meant, may our country live 10,000 years. Sergeant Shaw was capable of weeping objective, simulated tears at several points in the story of his life, which Captain Marco always encouraged him to tell to pass the time during quiet hours on patrol. The sergeant's rage-daubed face would shine like a ripped-out heart flung onto stones in moonlight. And the captain liked to hear the story because, in a way, it was like hearing Orestes gripe about Clytemnestra. Captain Marco treasured poetic, literary, informational, and cross-referenced allusions, military and non-military. He was a reader. His point of motive was that on many army posts, one's off time could only be spent drinking, bridge playing, or reading. Marco enjoyed beer, abjured spirits. He had no head for cards. He always seemed to win from his superior officers. His fellow officers were used up on conversations of a non-professional nature, so he transshipped boxes of books about anything at all back and forth between San Francisco and wherever he was stationed at the time, because he was deeply interested in the problems of Bilbao bankers, the history of piracy, the paintings of Orozco, the modern French theater, the jurisprudential factors in mafia administration, the diseases of cattle, the works of Yeats, the ramblings of the Bible, the novels of Joyce Carey, the lordliness of doctors, the psychology of bullfighters, the ethnic choices of Arabs, the origin of trade winds, and very nearly anything else contained in any of the books which he paid to have selected at random by a stranger in a bookstore on Market Street and shipped to him wherever he happened to be.